When I was a young girl, I had a teacher who used to encourage her students to drink glass after glass of milk. Somehow, she had developed the notion that milk boosted one's intellect. For this teacher, a scholar by heart and by training, there was nothing more precious, no currency more valuable than intelligence. On occasion, one of us would ask her point blank, "What's intelligence?" Each time, she would offer a different response. Intelligence is a baby's first words. Intelligence is the joke Hyunju made in math lesson this morning. Intelligence is three brothers holding hands. Intelligence is yellow. Her responses would drive us crazy, and now, some 30 years later, it's interesting to consider why. As children, we were in effect asking her to describe something for us in the most straightforward way we knew how. And although she would always respond in a manner that was open and even forthcoming, her actual responses would build on expressions that bore no apparent relation to what she was describing. The whole thing was pretty maddening, to be honest with you. That said, today, I'm inclined to be more sympathetic with my elementary school teacher. Over the years, I've learned that description can be a delicate challenge for the describer, too. The deeper you try to dig into the essence of the thing, the further you have to reach to come up with the right words to do justice to what you're describing. The nice thing is that it's possible to mix and match words in an infinite variety of combinations to help you do this. What's tough is that when they're mixed and matched in an unexpected or overly ambitious way, the rendition can become almost uninterpretable to the person on the other end. As an adult, I've been on both sides of this. When I hear a critic describe a particular wine as somewhat challenging but with significant cerebral appeal, or having a touch of menthol and green eucalyptus on the entry, along with generous notes of acacia honey and vanilla on the finish, I'm never quite sure what I'm supposed to do with the information. Likewise, there are few things I find as frustrating as poring over a 2,000-word review of the latest movie release, only to walk away still feeling unsatisfied. It's as if the reviewer got so caught up in the joys of prose that he neglected to address the reader's most fundamental questions. Yes, the acting was industrious and the lighting nervy, but was the movie any good? Was it worth seeing? On the other hand, each year about 200 students enroll in my class. If you were to ask me to characterize this group of students to you, you'd probably expect me to do so along predictable lines. You wouldn't expect me to tell you that they are soundproof or squeezably soft or that they need daily watering. You'd expect me to tell you that they are smart, witty, kind, or outgoing. A good description is one that captures distinctiveness along dimensions that make sense to us. If it doesn't do this, we have no means of figuring out where to place the described entity in our heads. But even though I know this, I'd still be tempted to liven up my description of my students to do them better justice, which would eventually lead me back to the thorny issue of vocabulary. When it comes to portraying something as complex as, say, an individual or a group of individuals, there remain too many words to play with. A person could be described as obnoxious, quaint, acerbic, fragile, loquacious, or energetic. It's the endless variety problem again. This is where a uniform method of description can be useful. What a uniform method of description does is put discipline around the words. It creates a common ground for our characterizations by enforcing a shared set of touch points, at the same time heading off an endless game of vocabulary mix and match. Consider, for example, one of the more popular methods of description around: the standard personality test. A personality test is a measurement tool designed to depict an individual's persona along a predetermined set of dimensions. There are, obviously, many variations of the test, but a rudimentary one can be devised from just two fairly self-explanatory dimensions: dominance, submissiveness, and friendliness, unfriendliness. What's appealing about this kind of measurement tool is the extent to which it can capture a disproportionate amount of information with parsimony. Most personality tests involve 4 or 5 dimensions, but even a crude 2-dimensional metric can be curiously revealing. To say that someone is an unfriendly submissive is to say a tremendous amount about them. Sure, you could extrapolate an additional set of descriptors, e.g., passive-aggressive, sulky, resentful, to flesh out the complexion more fully, but the nucleus of the description is there. This is what a good descriptive metric does. It gets to the heart of the matter. It captures the core of a characterization that could otherwise go on forever. In addition, it's impossible to study a 2x2 map such as this one and not project yourself onto it. It wouldn't take much to figure out which quadrant you belonged in. Similarly, it wouldn't take much to figure out where to place your friends, your family members, your coworkers. This is the second element of a good descriptive metric. It invites comparison. It depicts individual distinctiveness in a way that makes it possible to see connections that were not obvious up to that point. It can be oddly addictive in this regard. It generates that, "Oh, this is why George has always reminded me of Richard," pang of association.